This is the Propanon Podcast. Tune in.
All right. My guest today is Jesse Walker. Jesse is the books editor at Reason Magazine, where he has written on subjects like pirate radio, conspiracy theories, cults, and copyright law. He's also the author of the books Rebels on the Air, An Alternative History of Radio in America, and The United States of Paranoia, A Conspiracy Theory. I initially brought Jesse on the show to speak about that book, as there are so many great things in there, but the jewel of it is his discussion of conspiracy theories that existed throughout American history. So for instance, at the very beginning of the United States of Paranoia, Walker shows that conspiracy theories are nothing new in America. During the 1600s, American settlers believed that Native Americans were in league with Satan and they were plotting to kill them all. And so it continues throughout America's history. Walker's book was a great resource to have during the writing of my own book, Chapel Perilous, The Life and Thought Crimes of Robert Anton Wilson. So it makes sense then that we begin our conversation by discussing the literary legacy of Robert Anton Wilson. Is Wilson a major minor or minor major American writer? I also had a chance to speak with Jesse in depth about his book, The United States of Paranoia, and the topology he provides in there about analyzing conspiracy theories. So have a listen. I hope you enjoy it.
Open your fucking ears, jackass.
We were speaking briefly before about your book, The United States of Paranoia. And it was a resource that I went to in writing my recent work about Robert Anton Wilson. So thank you for that. And I wanted to just quickly ask you, being that this is sort of a Raw-centric podcast at the moment, what influence has the work of Robert Anton Wilson played on your own, work as a whole, but maybe more specifically in your 2013 book, The United States of Paranoia?
Well, aside from the obvious, which is that he's in the book and there's a chapter that is in large part about him and people like the Discordians and the Church of the Subgenius that were heavily influenced by him. I put him in the category I used to describe him and folks like that, Kerry Thornley, the subgenius folks, was the ironic style. These people who are, they're engaging with conspiracy theories not to prove them, not to debunk them. They might do that separately, but that's not, the main thing is to play with them and to sort of have them as this great American or global mutant mythos that you can deploy to your own ends. And in a sense, I mean, my book was not trying to be funny the way they were. I mean, sometimes I made lines where I was trying to be funny, you know, crack a joke. But I was trying to do a serious work of history. But it was in that same kind of vein of, I'm not writing this book to prove my favorite conspiracy theories. I'm not writing this book to debunk stupid conspiracy theories that people believe. I'm writing this book to just explore this world that people live in mentally, you know, no matter how much. I mean, sometimes it's rooted in something real. Sometimes it's completely fantastic. Most often there's like a seed of something real, but then they add all this sort of nonsense to it. But it doesn't, I mean, but it's just a landscape. It's like, I want to, in the same way that people like Bob Wilson were trying to explore conspiracy theories to play with them, to see what could be built with them, you know, when he put it through his own creative process and wrote, you know, those great novels. I wanted to do something similar. I mean, what I was doing was more mapping than creating, obviously, but it was in that same spirit. And I think that having been, you know, reading Robert Anton Wilson and others like him, but especially him since my teens, I mean, I guess I started reading him when I was 15 or 16, you know, that helped, you know, prepare me for the mindset that you need to do that, where you're not just always trying to tell people whether something is real or not. And not even doing something, which of course I do a lot of the time, and Wilson did a lot of time, of being in maybe mode, but even like beyond the maybe mode and saying, this is the as if mode. Let's just roll with the fact that people live in this mental space, whatever you think of that mental space. Because of like the Thomas theorem says, you know, there's a, even things that are not real have real consequences, or however that quote goes. I mangled it. So that mm-hmm. was a big that was a big influence on the book that came from him, especially from him and his circle.
Lovely. And what was, do you remember, you probably do, what was the first Wilson book that you read?
Oh, it was Illuminatus. Right. I found him through the Steve Jackson games, the Illuminati. I don't know if you would call it a card game, the original version. It was not a board game. It was not a card game. It was somewhere in between. But just some friends of mine who are into role-playing games, and this is not a role-playing game, they said they had this game, and I was not into role-playing games, but they were my friends, and they said, Jesse, this will appeal to your sense of humor. You should play with us. And it did, and I had fun with it. And I was sort of curious about learning more about what they were drawing on here. They referred to this book or this trilogy, although at that point you could only get it as a one volume book. And there was, the little essay by Bob Shea that was in there. And this was just around the time that they brought the one volume trilogy back into print. I think it had come out again about a year earlier. And the same friend of mine who got me into the game had a copy and loaned it to me. And then I started I already was sort of haunting the stacks of this science fiction bookstore in Chapel Hill, where I grew up in North Carolina, it was the Foundation Bookstore. Then it became the Second Foundation because someone else took over. I don't remember when it was at that point, but they would sell various other books of him. And it was always his, and it was always kind of random what would be in, but so I don't know the exact order, but I remember seeing Cosmic Trigger, the Illuminati Papers, the first two of the historical Illuminatus series. I Masks of the Illuminati just happened to be in the local library, or maybe it was a college library. And so I read a number of his books, and he came to town and talked also, which I got to, so I got to see him speak, meet him. I told him something after the speech that made him laugh, and I thought that was cool. You know, teenage me, this guy had made me laugh many times. Now I got to make him laugh. So it progressed from there. And it's kind of gratifying to be in this age. Now, there's a very few of us. There's like you, me, Eric Davis, Christian Greer, a couple other people who are trying to just like treat him as a figure worth taking seriously, both as a historical figure who was present at a lot of interesting times and places and represented a lot of sort of social trends, but also someone who's like a writer who had interesting things to say and who was overlooked because of, you know, of where he was writing and certain, and we can get into it later, certain things about his writing. Mm-hmm. And I'm glad to see some people doing scholarship. Often it's scholarship outside the academy, but at least it's some sort of scholarship, and some of it's inside the academy. And it's been good to see that sort of, it reminds me a little bit, though it's not at the same level, of when people started taking Philip K. Dick seriously in the late 1980s. And there was actually Eric Davis was part of that too, because he had that piece in, I think, The Village Voice. But you suddenly had people saying, hey, this was actually not just a pulp figure who, you know, he wrote the book that became Blade Runner and he won a Hugo for Man in High Castle. There is a really interesting, if uneven, but in many ways great, body of work that he's produced that really speaks to the times he lived in, and that we should be paying closer attention to. So maybe we're at that stage with Wilson now. I don't know, but it would be nice.
Right. I like how you say maybe. We are definitely maybe at that time. And one other thing that you said, I don't know if it was a tweet or maybe you're quoted, or it was from one of your essays or something, that piggybacks on what you just said, that more people have heard of Thomas Pynchon's Gravity Rainbow, but more people have read Wilson's Illuminatus trilogy.
Yeah, I think it was that more people have started Gravity's Rainbow, but more people have finished Illuminatus, you know.
Even better.
And I love Finchin, you know, but there are parts of Gravity's Rainbow that are like big barriers, you know. It's tough to get through here. And he put one of them right at the very beginning. Like, it is almost warning people of what's to come, you know. And Illuminatus isn't like that. Even when it's at its most experimental, it's extremely entertaining and inviting. And I think, I don't know if it's literally true that more people have finished it, but I certainly have that feeling. I mean, Pynchon, because he's been enshrined by the Academy, he's often just sort of discussed in these sort of hushed tones by people who then, when you probe a little closer, they haven't read much of him. Wilson, if people are talking about him, they're enthusiasts, you know. There's like no place where you're going to get status for having made your way all the way through the Illuminatus trilogy. Whereas, you know, that with V or Gravity's Rainbow, maybe that if I had gone to grad school, you know, maybe I'd be burnishing those as credentials or something.
Right. Well, I have to say, your quote fit me. I'm one of those people that started Gravity's Rainbow and didn't finish it. I think maybe it was that first part, the first wall with the description of the, I guess, the flight path of the missile and whatnot.
Yeah. And then this, it's like it's incredibly dense prose with these wonderful turns of phrases, but you have to concentrate. And did you read any of his other books though? Because some of them are actually more accessible than that.
Okay. Little bits, man. I have yet to really go down the rabbit hole of Pynchon's literature yet. I will tell you right now,
the most accessible thing he ever wrote, and I'm putting this here for our listeners because I figure there's overlap between the Wilson fans and people. He wrote a short story called The Secret Integration, 1964 or so, appeared in the Saturday Evening Post. So it's accessible enough to be in one of the most mainstream magazines in America at the time, you know, the place that published all those famous Norman Rockwell pictures. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, it's an amazing short story. I won't spoil the ending or anything of that to it, but it's almost like you read this and you think he's doing a satire of the yippies and then a lot of the stuff that's happening. You say, wait a minute, that's later in the decade. He's writing this in the early 60s. Interesting. And stuff in there about Bohemia and race relations. And so it's in a short story collection, Slow Learner.
Right.
Yeah. So, I mean, if someone wants the easiest possible, but still very rewarding entry point to Pynchon, I recommend that story.
Oh, it's called The Secret Integration.
Yeah.
Nice. Well, you know, moving on to very accessible, you know, work that like has a lot to say. I think maybe that is something people who are influenced by Wilson, you know, I picked that up from like your book right from the jump, from the very beginning. You know, maybe it's, I don't want to put too much of his influence on your work, but I'll say it for mine too, like his emphasis on imagery, you know, and how important it is to just present, you know, clear pictures to the reader and do so in like, you know, simple and accessible ways, like to get your point across. And it's something that people take for granted from, you know, good writing, but just like a bad movie, you know, it's bad, you know, but you don't quite notice when a good movie's good because you just sort of take it for granted.
Yeah. And he is very, he's good at that. And you're right that that's sort of an undersung talent, but there's sometimes like when you're like The Earth Will Shake, in many ways I feel like this is just a hunch I have, maybe someone said this to you when you were researching your book, he wanted to sort of sit down and say, you know what, I'm going to show everybody I can write a book that's just a straightforward linear adventure story. I mean, there's more to it than the adventure, but like genre novel that's strictly readable, no tricks, no cut-ups, and so on. And really, other than the fact that because it's the first in a series, it's it doesn't really have an ending. I mean, it has an ending, but it's not the end of the story. Mm-hmm. And the one of the storylines is introduced much later in the book than it ordinarily would be, because, again, it's part of this longer series. It really is that straightforward book. And then in the second book, he says, all right, now I'm just going to fuck with you again.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I'm going to have this long series of footnotes in these books. They're not even going to always be at the bottom of the page.
Yeah.
They're going to be an elaborate tribute to an obscure Irish writer, and also an exploration of some recent conspiracy tracts I've been reading.
Mm-hmm.
And he does that really well, too. And he makes it readable. So, and I think actually the thing that hurts him, I mean, something that he's really good at, but I think hurts his respectability, is he is great at pastiche.
Yeah.
He is great at, like, he's going to sit down. He's going to sound here. He's going to sound like H.P. Lovecraft. Here, he's going to sound like James Joyce. He's going to copy William Burroughs. Here, we know all the writers he really likes. There's others, like hard-boiled detective novels that I know he was a big fan of, but he didn't write as much about. But you can see him move into those modes. And it's usually a very loving pastiche. Sometimes he can be more satiric. Like, I don't know what he thought of Ian Fleming when he was doing the Ian Fleming copies in Illuminatus. Doesn't matter, because it's funny, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But because he's so good at imitation, it's easy to miss his own voice. And it's easy to think that that's all he does. Like, he's a skilled writer. He can do the sort of thing that 99% of people can't do. But but it's like the basics for any good, solid writer, of like doing a well-told story that draws people in and is told efficiently and effectively. But he's good at copying these different voices, but is there an underlying voice of his own? I mean, there isn't an obvious Wilsonian style, the way something is obviously like Burroughs or Pynchon or Dick, or some of the other writers that you might easily compare him to, like you sort of think of as similar and in the same period. I think there is an underlying style. And in fact, I remember we used to email, before he died. And I remember telling him that a book struck me as Wilsonian. And I asked him if he had read it, and he hadn't. And I was, and he says, what's Wilsonian about it? And I had to actually come up, what was it about this book that made me think of Robert Anton Wilson's work? And I couldn't recite what it, the book was. The Unfortunate Firsty, which is a very funny Irish novel from the 40s that satirizes the church and so on. But it's in a very not whatever you're imagining when I said satirizing the church. It's not what it does. Okay, his was sort of interesting. Like, here's a book he didn't know, a writer he doesn't know. Couldn't have been a direct influence on him. He couldn't have been a direct influence on it, obviously. Mm-hmm. So I think it would be interesting to see people starting to sort of delve into beyond the sort of historical and philosophical look at him, looks at what he's done, looking at it as literature. I mean, and people are not... I don't think he's one of, the top writers of the 20th century or anything like that as a stylist, but I think he's worth taking seriously for the same reasons that people like Philip K. Dick or Dashiell Hammett are worth taking seriously. And I think he's in that kind of, at the very least, he should be in that kind of status where, do you know Charles Williford? Does that name ring a bell for you?
No.
He's actually, Wilson liked his work too, but he was always marketed as a hard-boiled kind of crime writer, and his final books, when he finally got some commercial success, were a series about a detective, which he immediately tried to sabotage because he wanted to kill off the detective in the second book. And his agent was like, or editor or whoever, says, no, put this in the box.
Yeah.
But often, often it's like there's a crime in it, but it's not about the mystery or anything like that. And there's... and there's levels of satire, and there's this kind of almost Dostoevskian sort of like looks into the minds of the people who are doing these actions in these books. At any rate, he's at the level of cult. He has the kind of cult following that Wilson has, but you will periodically, like every 5 to 10 years, someplace like The Atlantic, we'll write a big article that says, hey, you should check out this writer. And Wilson's not at that level. He's still got this kind of disreputability, or at least I shouldn't say that, but he doesn't have the level of reputability. Like, there's no one is imagining a Library of America edition of his books like they've done for Octavia Butler, Philip K. Dick, and Charles Portis, and, you know, other folks who weren't necessarily seen as great literary figures in their lifetime, but looking back, people now say, yeah. And it would be interesting to get him up to that level where people can take him seriously as, all right, this is not Faulkner, but this is, he's on that next level down where, you know, you're interested in America in the late 20th century. This is someone you should maybe take a look at.
For sure. Yeah. So many great points right there, man. Like the notion of the text itself, like that, as you say, man, I mean, Wilson was not afraid to wear his influences on his sleeve. You know, he was, and that's what made him so interesting as well, too, because he is somewhat representative of, and of course, he's always talking about it, like the technological innovations of communication technologies, right? And so I think reading Illuminatus trilogy in some ways, if you equate it or analogize it to something, it's almost like having a bunch of windows open on your browser, you know, and like suddenly you're reading a little article about a recent book, and then you click to, in the middle of a sentence, an article about the LA fires or something like that. And this being Illuminatus specifically, right? Like, to me, it seems like a mashup of Burroughs and Joycean influences on Wilson's style of the text itself. Yet the two Bobs did something a little extra with that. I feel like it's not quite cut up, right? And it's not Joycean chaos. Again, to me, it reads almost like flicking through TV channels or clicking different windows from your internet browser. And I totally agree too, like literary figures, he almost like puts in the text, right? Like in Illuminatus that, hey, I'm homaging Joyce here. Yeah. And in that regard, like, I say this a lot now, like Doug Rushkoff, you know, once told me he called Bob like future heroic. And that's almost in the sense of maybe the fact that he's imitating, if you will, all these different styles, right? Or slightly satirizing all these different styles in his, you know, experimental prose, construction that becomes his books, right? And like, I love how you said that, like his The Earth Will Shake is Bob doing like a very, it's in some ways his most boring fiction book, but like it's not boring at all. It's only boring because he puts it in that,
that's a book he can loan to your 14-year-old kid. And I remember actually when she was like 14 or so, my older daughter, like picking up, and she always had a stack of 20 books and she never got to that one. But I remember her reading the back and say, oh, and Frankenstein. Yeah, right. This is, you know, so yeah. And that's, you're not necessarily going to hand somebody that age. I mean, I don't know. I was around that age when I read Illuminatus, a year or two older. But you'd have to be sort of more someone that you know is ready for something experimental. But yeah, and another thing, you just sort of sparked my thought when you're talking about like having the different windows open. A lot of the modernist writers, like a few decades earlier, were trying to recreate the sensation of having a newspaper open and having all these different articles, like Dos Passos would do these media collages. One of the things that inspired the cut-up method of Burroughs and Geisen was the idea that you could have two articles side by side and something new emerges from the space in between them because your eye kind of slips over, you know, which is a little bit different from that. And I want to say Wilson was doing the internet in advance. Maybe that's giving him a little bit too much credit because it's a, because what was really influencing him more than anything else in terms of new media was film, you know, and trying to represent, the page what you could do with editing and montage and so forth with the camera. And sometimes very old, I mean, like one of his favorite movies was Intolerance, which came out in 1916. You know, I mean, some of these are very old influences, but I mean, by the time he was writing, rather old texts, but not ones that had necessarily been fully incorporated into what people writing on the page were trying to do. But he really took a shine to the internet as soon as it came along. And you know, some of his later works, he was certainly trying to evoke that spirit. And it's of a piece with, and you know what, I mean, even before the internet, there were multimedia works that were influencing writers, including him. And so I don't know. I don't think it's anachronistic to say, or not completely anachronistic to say, that in that book that came out in 1975, or that trilogy that now we think of as one book, you know, he was doing the internet just slightly ahead of time. And you can imagine how the Bobs would have loved being able to write in hypertext if they had been able to do that, you know, and just sort of everybody time you go. I mean, you had some people like Cortazar who had kind of experimented with that, but like, go to this page now or whatever. Yeah. But you were not doing the choose your own adventure thing so much, you know. And like, if anyone was going to like cross like a choose your own adventure book with a Joyce or Burroughs style experimental text, you know, it was going to be Robert Anton Wilson. You could just imagine. Leary got to do some video game design, and you can imagine Wilson wishing he had had the opportunity or the cachet that Leary had, that he would be able to do a project like that.
Oh, heck yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think this is you know, when the Raw Studies Journal comes out, this would be a very good article for debate. Was Wilson's work sort of proto internet, or did it predict the internet in some ways? Because interviewing some people for my own work, and then, I mean, my own thoughts on it too, but say people who discovered Cosmic Trigger when it first came out, all that information that was so new at the time, that, you know, Wilson was breaking stories in the counterculture. You know, he's sort of the first to really give shine to the McKenna brothers, you know, which in that book in Cosmic Trigger, that's sort of a, you know, forgotten sort of footnote in there, if you will. I mean, it's in the text, it's not in the footnote, but then, you know, he's, as Saul Paul Sarag, the particle physicist and a good buddy of Wilson's from that time, in Berkeley, told me, you know, Bob was the first one to get it right as far as presenting the recent experiments, you know, by Alan Aspect and, the other fellows there who eventually won the Nobel Prize in physics only a couple years ago for their work that Bob was writing about.
I think that also, I mean, the way he uses the metaphor of the network there in that very book, or the influence, I mean, like, cybernetics was obviously a big influence on him. I mean, he was writing stuff in the 60s that was, you know, applying that to politics and so on. And you know what you just made me think of? I don't remember where it was. Maybe it was in Cosmic Trigger 3. One of his books, he has the idea of PO, and it's just sort of a way of joining two concepts together. And it really is, what he's describing there is, I don't know if you do this, but sometimes, especially, I mean, sometimes just for the hell of it, and sometimes if I'm just trying to, if I'm in the midst of research, I will just Google two names or two phrases together and see what comes up, look for right. overlaps. And it's the exact thing he was talking about doing with Poe, P-O, it sounds like I'm thinking about Edgar Allan Poe if I don't say that. And it's, but now we have this engine that will produce a result for you and feed it back to you, which is interesting, isn't it? Sure. Yeah.
I love that. Yes, man. Yeah, there are many possible arguments for Wilson as proto internet, and yeah, Poe. Right. It's so much easier to do that now. And yeah, he got that from Edward de Bono, right? And I think, just backtracking for a quick minute to give Wilson some props, because some people that I've interviewed were like, hey, this was the cool thing about Wilson, was that he was so open about giving props to the people who influenced him. But he did it in his own way. And if Wilson has a unique voice, maybe it comes out also in his nonfiction, yeah, like about synthesis, if you will. And like, he's always, he's thinking about like how his last book that he never put out, you know, the Tale of the Tribe, right? This was pretty much about the internet, right? But he died before it came out. But the
well, he died before he finished it, unfortunately. I
mean, that's exactly. Yeah, he died before he finished it. He didn't get very far. But I guess to just that's something that I return to asking, like, what is Bob's unique contribution? And maybe it's just his whole approach, right? And you speaking about approaches,
though, he's very overt about doing pastiches, but sometimes he'll slip in things too. Like there is I think it's in Earth Will Shake. It's in that one. It's in one of the historical Illuminatus books. There is a whole scene of, I guess it's Sigismundo, listening to a sermon and having the shit scared out of him. And I'm certain that this is an homage. I mean, it's not the only thing he's doing, an homage to the sequence like that in Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man, right? I mean, there's no way that Wilson, the great Joyce fan, is not thinking of that. And it's not like he's trying to slip one past us. Everyone knows he's a big Joyce fan, but I'm sure that's an he's made little allusions to Mencken. I had an argument with my former boss, the late Bill Bradford, because he was convinced that the opening to Wilson's old Fact Magazine profile of Madeline Marie O'Hare has this sort of nod to the opening of a Mencken essay. And Bill was convinced it was plagiarism. I'm saying, no, this is an allusion. This is how it works. You know, this is a wink. He's not, again, he's praised Mencken many times. There's no question that Mencken is like a writer that Wilson holds in esteem, although his style is not generally a lot like Mencken's. But he's willing to like go there and do that in this kind of context. He wears his influences on his sleeve most of the time, but he's also willing to do, you know, the more subtle kind of in jokes and allusions and winks and things like that as well.
Oh, no question. I mean, he is skilled in just the craft of writing. Yeah. Like he was going to be an English teacher he went to the NYU teaching program at some point, but he did, he taught himself the canon. Like he wanted to be a writer in the lineage of Hemingway and all these other people in the American canon. Yeah. Just a writer that had great influence in creating the great American novel and whatnot. And
I will say, for whatever it's worth, because I'm not a great literary figure, but I mean, I learned a lot about writing there are some writers who were influences on me just on the level of looking at how they crafted things and how they put things together and the mechanics of it. And Wilson was absolutely one of those for me. I learned a lot just from like watching, paying attention to how he did things. In the same way that, you know, he was looking back at these other folks. So I think he has influence like that too. I'm sure I'm not the only person like that who could say that. And there are other writers I could say who are on that same level of fame as Wilson, like not huge figures, but I learned a lot just from watching how does he do this? And that is, that's not anything to sneeze at either. Notable literary figure, hopefully to get more attention in the future.
Heck yeah. And with, you know, works like your book, mine, and, you know, Eric Davis's, the work of Christian Greer and many others, Adam Gould-Wrightley, I think that he's well on his way, you know, to get his academic nod, if you will. Bob, of course, got into conspiracy theories in such an interesting way. And as you said, him and his crew, including Paul Krasner and the Discordians, Kerry Thornley and Greg Hill and others, or maybe it was a zeitgeist, sort of a crafting or creating the ironic style, which I really appreciate the way you put that in the book, because that's completely true, you know, because as Alan Moore spoke about, you know, before Bob, like the discussion of conspiracy theories was in some sort of rat trap, militia group huddle or something like that. And Wilson kind of liberated the notion of conspiracy theories, just like he did magic in some ways, right? And I think, again, the way that he's able to kind of relayed his information in very clear, concise ways. You really accomplished that with the United States Paranoia. And I really appreciate your approach in that book, Jesse, like, because you get into the, you break it down very well by presenting some historical context where this sort of notion of thinking about people as holding conspiracy theories and conspiracy theorists, if you will, and it's become such a part of our culture to the term conspiracy theory and conspiracy theorist is like, I wonder, like, 100 years ago, this term even, obviously it didn't even really exist, but as you put in your book, conspiracy theories did exist.
Yeah, I mean, it was used then, and actually there's a book coming out later that'll get into this history that I didn't write. It was used in things like crime reporting, like the conspiracy theory of what happened. You know, it was very different. And the idea of the conspiracy theorist are what we imagine when we say that, the sort of three or four archetypes that come to mind. You know, one of them in that militia cell, one of them a hippie, you know, who's been like, has got a shelf full of JFK books, you know, a couple other. That I think really kind of emerges in the 60s and 70s. The phrase conspiracy theory by then was being used not just in the old crime reporting way to describe what we would now call conspiracy theories, and often as a pejorative. It didn't have the kind of connotations it does now. And maybe there was not yet this concept of a paranoid style, quote unquote, that certain people had, that there was a kind of person that you would call a conspiracy theorist. That is really, that kind of emerges from people, it happens a lot in sociology. You create a category by discovering it. So there's this long history of people holding conspiracy theories. And they're generally the conspiracy theories that follow from, like, they're on the left, so they have these left-wing conspiracy theories. They're in the John Birch Society, they have the Bircher-type conspiracy theories. Their particular religious group holds these conspiracy theories, whether you call them conspiracy theories or not. But the idea of someone being interested in conspiracy theories per se, like, oh, because I'm interested in this Reform Democrats book on the JFK assassination, I might also be interested in this Bircher's book on the bankers. You know, that is something that you have some emerging before then. Like the if you read old issues of the Fortean Society's newsletter, they're not, I mean, it's there, although it's also mixed up with they're going to be interested in the Loch Ness Monster. So it's not completely invented in the 60s and 70s, but it really becomes a subculture then, or at least beyond that kind of small Fortean group. It becomes a subculture, which it wasn't before. And it's interesting. I mean, I mentioned the paranoid style. That's, of course, Richard Hofstadter's term from essay, The Paranoid Style of in American Politics, which he originally gave as a lecture the day before the JFK assassination. So there's a great synchronicity for you. But when people start talking like that, I wonder to what extent the critique of the conspiracy theorist then attracted people to the archetype of the conspiracy theorist. Like, you're going after people like me, I'm going. And of course, it also attracts satirists. You know, that's part of what drew in Robert Anton Wilson and Robert Shea, who, of course, I mean, at least in Wilson's case, had conspiracy theories that he subscribed to. But it was... And others that he mocked. But when he just sort of having the ironic style of conspiracy theory presupposes the idea of there being a style that you would call of conspiracy theory, you know, so it really is, I think, something that's although conspiracy theories are older than America, and my book is like a history of these conspiracy stories that have been told again and again, and not just out on the fringes, but by very powerful people. And I think it's something that's sort of core to human existence. People are going to devise conspiracy theories. This category of the conspiracy theorist, as we think of them today, is not much older than I am.
Mm-hmm. For sure. Yeah. And, you know, this notion of like, what were conspiracy theorists called, or that notion before the term, and some say the term being invented, was it by the CIA?
No, that's not true.
That's a conspiracy theory.
It is a conspiracy theory because I saw that. I first read that like right when my book was coming out, and I didn't like, and I thought, oh wow, if the, I mean, I knew that, that the term was older because I read texts, but I said, wow, I mean, this would really kind of, this would be an interesting twist. I didn't feel like it was challenging what I was saying, you know, if, boy, if the CIA itself created it, but it didn't. If you read that, that document people point to, there's only like the phrase conspiracy theory or theorist, like variants on it, only appear like twice in it. I mean, it's just about, I mean, they don't like what people were saying about the Kennedy assassination, but there's nothing in there that says, so we are going to call these people conspiracy theorists. You know, they just use that phrase a couple times in passing, and people have really, oh God, what's his name? Lance. I'm forgetting his last name. But he tries to make the argument that it sort of takes off in use after this memo goes out. But I'm not convinced that's true, because I've seen like some work that goes back older that shows sort of the rise and fall of people using the phrase and actually using it as a pejorative, like in Britain, like a century ago. You know, although the archetype might be recent. Again, people have used that language a long time, as well as having theories for a long time. But even setting that aside, it just seemed to me that there are all sorts of reasons why you would expect that phrase to take off in the late 60s and the 70s, and that tracing it all to this memo was just not, you would need a lot stronger evidence than he had put together.
Right on.
DeHaven Smith, that's it. Lance DeHaven Smith.
Okay.
His name. Yeah, yeah.
Well, I guess this leads into the next part of the conversation. You know, what you present in your book, you know, being five conspiracy types. Right. And I like that, you know, five, the law of fives coming through, that Discordian law of fives. But, you know, I really like how you present these, so simple, but so they explain so much. The enemy outside, which is sort of self-explanatory, this being the idea or the theory that there's some outside group that wants to attack the village, if you will, and we have to be on guard. The enemy within, which increases one step in complexity because the conspirators lurk within the system. And so one has to be a little more hypervigilant, I guess, to find the conspirators within the system. And of course, I'd say the most famous in recent American history, right, is the McCarthy witch trials and whatnot, and the search for the great commie bastards.
That one's a bit of a mixture because the enemy is headquartered in Moscow. So it's an enemy outside too. But actually you say witch trials, that's the classic one. Anyone could be a witch, right?
The Salem witch trials.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah,
okay. Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. You got into that a little bit in your book. Yes. Like where they were convinced that these women were witches. That's a great point. And then of course, the third type, the enemy above, which is super interesting, that being powerful people manipulating events to their own end. And that's the realm of Illuminatus trilogy, right? And the complexity there that I think you get into in the book a little bit too, it's not just one, it's Mount Olympus, right? It's the Greek gods. They're all fighting with each other. And then they're playing with us little humans, you know, for fun and whatnot. The enemy below, which is the lower classes, you know, seeking to overthrow the current culture and whatnot. A lot of theories out there today about that. And then, of course, I love how you bring this in, the benevolent conspiracies.
Which is also in Illuminatus. You know,
yes. But I, and that how you just kind of get in the book, you know, conspiracy of angels, angelic forces that are working behind the scenes to help us in our everyday life. I always mispronounce his name, but Dan Bresny, called Pronoia, right? Pronoia.
What was he the one who coined that? I was thinking it was John Perry Barlow, but now
I don't know, but now
you got me questioning myself. But at any rate, at any rate.
All good. Question myself every day. I don't know. He put the book out called Pronoia, but I don't know if he coined the term per se.
Yeah. Now I'm trying to think of who said it first, and I don't remember. It might be in my book. I might say in there.
I
might even be right. Maybe. And actually, that's another one that I'm pretty sure the seeds of, including the benevolent conspiracy, was planted by Wilson. Who, I mean, sometimes in interviews would make the point of saying, you know, there are also theories where the Illuminati are the good guys, where they're the benevolent sages based in Tibet or Mount Shasta, who are or wherever, who are guiding us towards a higher level of evolution. And that's one of the that might have been where I first encountered the notion, like, yeah, I got to include these alongside the and some people who write about the book, they just leave that out entirely. They'll even say, like, there's four archetypes in here, because they're not quite sure how to handle the benevolent ones being thrown in there. But I think it's a key part of the story, especially since one thing that happens is some new age type will write a book which posits a benevolent conspiracy. The Rosicrucians are helping us rise up or whatever. And then a fundamentalist Christian will find that book and see it as evidence of what they see as a demonic conspiracy. So the chain of transmission goes back and forth. The chain of influence goes back and forth. And if you're looking at the history of the demon theories, you kind of have to have the angel theories mixed in, because that's part of how these ideas evolved and spread.
I like that. Yeah, the demon theories, because before conspiracy theory, there was like the notion of demonology, right? Mm-hmm. And that, I mean, even further back, I mean, I guess some people make the argument that the roots of conspiracy theory kind of lay in the roots of anti-Semitism, perhaps, you know?
Yeah, but it's older than anti-Semitism. Generally, when you hear that, it's from people who are scholars of anti-Semitism, mm-hmm. and they really know the history of anti-Semitism, and they don't know the history of other sorts of conspiracy theories, and they're not aware that actually it's broader than this. So I don't think I think it's older than anti-Semitism. I mean, conspiracy theories are older than Jews, right? I mean, I'm sure primitive man out on the tundra or wherever was having conspiracy theories about what that other group of people hunting over there were up to. So, but yeah. I'm sorry, I interrupted you.
No, you just sparked a great thought, like, or a great question. Like, cause I do this sometimes, like, at what point did the Homo sapien come up with this cultural behavior? Right. When did we start using shoelaces? When did we start, you know, using Q-tips or whatnot? But when did we start, you know, doing the out group? And of course, for, you know, speaking, I guess, but we'll getting Wilsonian in a way, we were throwing shit at each other before we could even speak.
Right? Yeah, he has that great phrase he always liked to use, mammalian politics. And right. You're making me wonder now, like, what conspiracy theories do different colonies of rats have about each other?
I love it.
We don't know because we don't know what level of cognition they have. But so it's a who knows.
Right. No, if you observe animals long enough, you will definitely see like some distinct behavior patterns. And maybe, I mean, of course, like the pecking order, like with birds and whatnot, or even with cats. And
we are pattern seeking, storytelling creatures, and we have things to be afraid of. And if you can spot patterns, and if you can tell stories, and if you can feel fear, you're going to have conspiracy theories. Some of which will even be true.
Right.
So, you know, it's prehistoric. It's very ancient.
Yes. Right on. I love that.
Fortunately, I was only writing about the history since the colonization of America. Otherwise, my book would be the size of 5 Encyclopedia Britannicas, and I'd still be writing it.
Yeah. Right. The anthropological history of people's madness. But I love that, you know, you framed it, your book, you know, obviously the United States of Paranoia within, you know, the context of the Republic. And I mean, you know, the notion is often discussed in articles all the time. It's like, well, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? And, but here we are today. I mean, from my own watching the news in the last number of years, I mean, you know, and objectively, this has happened, you know, where they've become more politically entrenched, like MSNBC and CNN, and obviously Fox News, and things became so like rigidly red or blue. It's very hard to distinguish the signal from the noise, like the actual vital political news from political propaganda, you know. Mm-hmm. And I imagine that's what everyone is feeling, and we're about to head into a water slide of narcissistic madness, I think, in about 2 weeks. So
it's a rerun, though, you know. I mean, it's like it the first time Trump became president, there's this big question, like, what's coming? And this time it's like, I know what's coming. You know, I mean, you don't know what's coming because who knows what new things will be thrown at him. For him, I mean, by the world, by reality that he has to respond to. Also, you don't know how long he's going to be alive, because in a year we might, because he's old and losing it. And we might be talking about President J.D. Vance in a year. Right. But I really feel like we're kind of in this sort of stasis point. We have been. I feel like when Trump left office and COVID kind of died down, like sort of the national emergency around COVID, obviously the virus is still out there. I felt like we left an era of history, and we have not yet gotten around to joining another one. It's like we've been we were in stasis with the Biden regency, you know, like being governed by the people around Biden. And we're going to be more stasis. Like it's like, we're turning things over from the man in the retirement home who just sits silently in his room staring at the TV and eating soup, to the man in the retirement home who rants incoherently at the bird on his ledge. But they're both, you know, the man in the retirement home, and it's someone who's already been in power. The people, I know there are reasons to think things will be a little bit different, in the, even that he doesn't owe Trump doesn't owe what he owed before to the party, the GOP, and there are people who say, well, now he's got folks like RFK and Tulsi Gabbard who are anti-establishment, and it's going to be different politics, and Vance is different. But really, I mean, I don't know when this is going to go up, but we're recording this, I think it was yesterday, maybe the day before, but yesterday, that Tulsi Gabbard said, oh, no, I'm not going to favor this in order to get the Senate to vote for me. I'm not going to favor this this section. I'm blanking on the number of it, but you know, the surveillance reform that she, among other people, have been pushing for years, you know, and that just sort of lines for, like, not that I expected Tulsi Gabbard to be this big change. Like, I mean, obviously she was like the, of all the other foreign policy appointees were just conventional Republican hawks. And she was, all right, so she's the only one who might some of the time have a more interesting and supportable point of view, though not all the time. And now I'm saying, boy, she's not even going to have that little burst of interest. You know, she's folding on this. So it's like, it's the same old, you know, I mean, I say this, and then maybe he'll invade Greenland next month, so who knows? But it's very, I do still have this feeling like we're waiting for the next phase of history to get on with it. And I don't know what it'll take to dislodge us from this. But yeah, so we'll have the water slide, but it's like our fifth time down this water slide, and it's not just awful, it's now boring. It's gone from being awful and interesting to being awful. And it's like, because Trump is predictable. Trump's acolytes are predictable. A lot of Trump's critics are predictable. And keep making the same stupid mistakes again and again. I don't know. I really hate to make predictions. And now I feel like I don't even have to make predictions, because it's like there's no future for now. At some point there will be. But who knows how long we'll be stuck in this rut.
As John,
I don't know if you agree with that or not. Maybe I'm just getting.
To add a little bit to that, just thinking what you're saying about Tulsi Gabbard, that's very interesting, you know, because for so long she kind of presented herself as a bit of a renegade. And of course, you know, her whole thing was to not get involved in regime change wars. Right. And mm-hmm. and she, of course, was in the military and saw active military service. So why is Tulsi Gabbard backpedaling now? People have ideas as to why. One might be that there's a cadre of faceless bureaucrats just waiting in an office, or as Bill Hicks said, you know, the back secret room behind the Oval Office, and they show them another angle of the Zapruder film, you know, and that feeds into, I guess, the notion of deep state theories and whatnot.
I mean, with Gabbard, though, I mean, it's Section 702. I'm sorry, I was having a brain fart before, but FISA Section 702 is where she's where she's kind of selling out. I think it really just comes down to getting the votes from people like Tom Cotton in the Senate, you know, from the more conventional hawkish Republicans who weren't necessarily going to vote for her. And she's like, she's doing what she, I mean, she's always been like many politicians, she can be opportunistic. And I think, I mean, they haven't even, I mean, it's not like she's even been like sworn in or approved, you know, as DNI director. So it's, you know, you don't even have to get to the back room kind of scenario yet. It just seems like sort of naked self-interest. And I can see, I mean, look, my position on her even before this was that I'm glad that there will be, I mean, this is as good as you can expect from Trump. I'm glad there will be someone who is a part-time dove among the full-time hawks that he's appointing to the foreign policy positions. And now I guess she's even more of a part-time dove, and I'm not enthused about her at all. I don't have hopes for her, but I recognize that if you don't appoint her, they would probably appoint someone worse. So if someone wants to say, yeah, if you're in the Senate, this is hold your nose and vote for it. But I just don't see like the folks who are saying, oh, this time there's going to be the great anti-establishment millennium coming. No. Trump is still the same guy he was the first time he was in office. You were deluding yourself if you thought there would be, and especially if you voted for him. Setting that aside, but just analysts, you know, and the analysts are like afraid of it too. I mean, it's like, no, I mean, it's not, I know. Anyway.
Yeah. Oh, no, totally. I mean, this is a thing of maybe education and politics and presidential campaigns that you have to hold everything that politicians say on the campaign trail in a grain of salt, right? And, you know, learn that. I mean, that was a whole big thing with the first George Bush. And I think maybe I experienced something when Obama was elected. And I thought that he would bring some interesting change to things. And the first sense of deflation was when he picked his cabinet, right?
Oh, yeah, Hillary. He was the rebel against, he was supposed to be the rebel against the Democrats who backed the Iraq war. And then who does he pick for Secretary of State? The very person he was challenging. Yeah. Now I had no particular hopes for Obama. I preferred him to McCain because I thought McCain was going to double down on the mistakes that got us into Iraq. Whereas Obama, I did not delude myself into thinking he was a dove, but I did think he wanted to use power less recklessly. And he recognized from the start that Iraq was a reckless and stupid act of power. So that's preferable, you know, in the same way that Eisenhower Eisenhower's foreign policy. He was not a dove, but he was a lot better than a lot of the other Cold War presidents because he had this sort of sense of not being reckless, although I would say some of the things the Dulles brothers did under him were kind of reckless. Comparing him to other presidents. You know, I'm old enough to remember people who were disillusioned by Bill Clinton. and for that matter, I know people, on the libertarian right who were disillusioned by Reagan, who they really thought was going to be something other than what he was. So, you know, I guess some sort of disillusionment with elected officials is built into following politics from any kind of dissident or radical point of view.
For sure. And this is the interesting question or thing that gets raised about Trump and the sense that he was labeled the conspiracy theory president, right? and, you know, by certain areas of the media, right? Certain channels. And I mean, he even recently about the LA fires, he put out some nonsense about Newsom not signing some act that, you know, turns out didn't even exist, right? Mm-hmm. Or of course his most famous sham or whatever was seeking the birther thing with Obama, you know, trying to prove that Obama was born in Kenya, or not even trying to prove it. He didn't even care about trying to prove it, just putting it out there. But the irony is that
he pretended he was trying to prove it. And he said, we're finding all this evidence. And then he never presented the evidence.
With Trump.
And the ultimate of this, it's not as like historically significant as the birther thing, but it really kind of completely sums it up was when he was saying that Ted Cruz's dad maybe being involved with the Kennedy assassination, and his and then dropped it immediately as soon as Cruz endorsed him, of course. And his source was the Weekly World News. It was the National Enquirer. Brain fart there again. And that's really the difference, because there have been lots of conspiracy theories presidents. I mean, that's one of the things that you learn from reading United States of Paranoia is it's very common for people in power to have conspiracy theories. They're just not called conspiracy theories because it's mainstream, right?
But Trump they also didn't tweet them, though.
But also Trump is shameless. That's what's different about him is that, you know, he has no problem pointing to a supermarket tabloid as his source. And he wouldn't even sort of launder it through someone more. I mean, John Kerry is a JFK conspiracy theorist. And when people asked him about it, when he was Secretary of State, he was like, it wouldn't be appropriate for me to talk about that. You know, whereas if you ask Trump, you know, so who do you think killed Kennedy? Who knows what 15-minute ramble you might get, which at some point, you know, he'd probably be saying windmills killed him. You know, I mean, like how many of his obsessions he would work into it.
The birds.
Yeah. They killed the birds and they get, we don't know. He didn't drive into a windmill. It could have happened. A Trump voice. I don't know whose voice that was. I just broke into.
But. Well, I mean, you'll get it, though, because we'll hear it a lot. But so with where we're at now, it seems like, right, it's this collapse, this inward collapse of you know, being able to even make sense of these things, meaning so the five conspiracy types. And this is what's so great about your book is that, you know, Wilson's work, it gives you the motivation to keep, you know, maintaining a topology, because another writer, Michael Barkun, talked about in his own book, A Culture of Conspiracy. And you touch on this, obviously, like in the 50s, you have the right wing conspiracy people, the John Birch Society. In the 60s, you sort of have the left wing ones that are, you know, the CIA killed Kennedy, right? And then these two things make way in the 80s. But somewhere in the 90s, there's a convergence, especially by the late 90s, there's the conspiracy culture that emerges. And I have to take note that I find it very interesting, the intersection with the technology, but also capitalism, obviously. Like you can now sell conspiracy theory. So
I should just as a asterisk next to what you said, you had the mixing before the 90s, and in fact, you had niche publications, you know, and then this is like, you know, people selling things again that would have that intersection. But the 90s is when you have people meeting on internet forums, and that's when it becomes a flood, or at least relative to what it was before. It was suddenly so much easier for the hippies and the militiamen and the UFO buffs and the black nationalists and so on to start just be reading each other, interacting with each other, taking what they want from each other's without losing their own obsessions, although some of them, you know, that actually go a little further towards each other. And that was a real turning point, I think.
Thanks again to Jesse Walker. That was such a great conversation. And be sure to check out his work at reason.com and read his book, The United States of Paranoia. I can't speak highly enough of it. Also, if you haven't already, please be sure to check out my book, Chapel Perilous, The Life and Thought Crimes of Robert Anton Wilson. And until next time, peace out.
You've been listening to the Propanon Podcast on the fucking internet. You've been listening to the Propanon Podcast on the fucking internet.